Welcome today to our interview series with Outstanding Professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Mark Mueller Eberstein, CEO, COO, author, speaker, mentor, coach, and strategist. Mark, you have a remarkable career with many, many, many successes. So thank you for sharing your considerable expertise, deep accumulated insights, and wisdom with our audience.
Thank you, Stephen. Really appreciate being here. It's an honor talking with you and having the chance to share some of the insights we've gained over the last years with the IT professional community and especially the IP3 community. Both of these communities have a very special place in our environment. In my career, I found them. Those were the people that really make the change happen. Often they're in the background, but we find more and more that they are the driver behind the business success for many large organizations. We often hear about the challenges these people in the IT profession are facing when working on the intersection between their own area of expertise and the owners of business processes and the business functions they're supporting and they're collaborating with. Firsthand, often we see that how improving the communication between them, introducing how collaboration on sharing of goals, targets, and best practices can really make a difference of how successful these organizations drive technology adoption, leverage the benefits technology can bring to them. Communities like IP3 are super important. Sharing experiences and learning from each other are those invaluable assets that make us and all of us successful as individuals, as organizations, as in a society overall in general. I'm very thankful that you give me the opportunity here to be today and share some of my experiences as well as I've done with my book Agility that has just been released. Personally, I'm very, very excited. I just returned from Atlanta from a Microsoft sales and marketing conference and had the chance there to talk briefly about the book, and it actually became the bestseller at the conference. So I'm really excited being here today and looking forward to our discussions.
Well, you know, Mark, I guess it's because your book is about real-world experiences, and it provides real value as a result that can be implemented through many kinds of organizations. So I would also recommend the book.
Thank you very much, Stephen. Yes, I think we have got endorsements from across the industries, the IT industry, people from HP, leadership in Microsoft, of course, have read it and supporting it, but also in the partner community and in the people that are actually leveraging those technologies. We found very, very good feedback on the topics itself, on the recommendations before we actually put them down and be able to publish them. So it's available now on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and the local bookstores, so we're really excited to have the opportunity to share this information and looking very much forward to engage with the community and getting the feedback.
Well, you know, Mark, we'll talk a little bit more about your book later in this interview because I think it's just so fascinating what's contained within the book itself. Now, you just mentioned HP, so can you talk about your role at HP and what key lessons you want to share with the audience?
I would be happy to do this, Stephen. HP has a very, very special place in my heart because this is actually where I got my start, my professional start in the IT industry. I was living in Germany. I was running my own marketing company at that point in time when I actually bought my first HP product, the HP DeskJet 500. I'm not sure who of the listeners still remembers that, but that was the inkjet printer that changed the way we actually thought about computer printing for a long time. It's hard to imagine that today when you get a printer with free, basically, with the purchase of a new PC or for a couple of bucks, that a little over 15 years ago, such a device cost over $1,000 in today's money. So quite a difference and a good example of how much value IT can deliver today to an individual or to an organization. It's interesting, though, I think the device itself is also actually a good example of what IP was and partly still is today. It's really a device that turned innovation into reliable function. It was a device that technology was far beyond the competition. Simply a great piece of engineering that defined a product category for many years to come. And it itself, again, is an example of what the old HP, the old Hewlett-Packard, made it such a unique and successful company over the decades with loyal customers in many business areas. A great piece of engineering. Personally, I joined HP shortly after in the German subsidiary And I was responsible there as a product manager in their marketing sales organization for a variety of products, basically everything from pocket calculators, over-the-printers, to PCs, later on to enterprise output management solutions and integration of those with ERP and SCM solutions, or the supply chain management solution. I had the opportunity to work with companies like SAP and Oracle in building partnerships that ultimately helped our joint customers to be far more efficient in how their business processes could be supported by IT. Then I moved up the corporate ladder and eventually ended it up in the Hewlett-Packard's headquarters here in the United States, and relocated myself and the family. It's interesting to see, to look back at HP and look at it in the mid to end 90s, when HP's enterprise sales organization was really focusing on these big machines. Unix, the HP 9000s were the key revenue drivers at that time. HP 3000, the proprietary system, was still driving a lot of revenue there. And they looked at the PC department and printer department of HP and called it lovingly the Toys R Us department. And it's also a good lesson to learn there, because at the end of the day, the focus on the unwillingness to embrace the change as aggressively and to cannibalize their own business led to a big step backwards. And basically, Compaq at that time came in and took over a business segment that HP had owned and dominated for so long it easily could have built on top of it. It's kind of ironic that HP later on bought Compaq to basically make up for that lost opportunity. The driver behind this was really Windows. When Microsoft's Windows came out, it drove the commoditization and the reduction in the individual device prices, and it became less and less relevant where a particular piece of hardware comes from, and more importantly, what it could deliver, what the price point was, and the competition changed to a completely different level. I think that is something we can actually see today when it becomes less and less relevant how an IT capability is delivered, but the cloud provides an alternative to on-site implementation. So it's becoming now less about a vendor. It becomes less about a particular piece of hardware or a particular piece of software. It really gets down to capabilities. And that's one of the things we have done with Agility, with the analysis there together with Boston University and MIT, to really looking at IT capabilities in specific organizations, independent how they are delivered, if they are implemented on-premise, if they are derived through cloud technology, or outsourced experience, and really see what is the business impact of those technologies. HP went through a lot of change over the last 15 years. When I started, it was still led by Lou Platt, but the transition already started there. Lou split the company basically in two. He focused on the computer business, which became the new HP, and then split out the measurement and testing business under what became Agilent. And also started a cultural transformation, from the engineering-focused company to a more sales-oriented company. Then when Carly Fiorina came on board, this changed dramatically. She really brought marketing thinking much more into the organization and shook it up at the roots, I would say. And I think there's probably a lot of stories and written about it. How was this good? Was it worth the change? I think that's a topic for another time we can happily talk about. But nevertheless, HP went through this big change, and the acquisition of Compaq happened at that time. So when Mark Hunt eventually took over the company, it had not much to do with the Hewlett-Packard of Mr. Hewlett and Mr. Packard from two decades before. And it has become now one of those strong players in the industry that is back again on providing great products, great solutions for their customers, and great solutions for their customers. One of the things, one of the little anecdotes I would like to share is to see what HP never was afraid of is driving innovation. It's really thinking new ways and driving those forward to product completion. In one of my first roles at HP, I was responsible for PC marketing, and one of those devices at HP at that time in the mid-90s, mid to late 90s, invented and introduced was a very light laptop computer called the Omnibook. The Omnibook 300, I think, if I remember correctly, was the first version. It was, I would say, not such a great success at that time, but if you look at pictures of it, you find them on the internet, they look very, very close to what a netbook is today. It's a light PC, it was relatively powerful at that time, and it really could have changed fundamentally. It was definitely, or fundamentally how people would work with their computers, but it was just 10 years ahead of that time. So, on the printer side, they were super successful. On the notebook side, or the netbook side, just 10 years early. But I think at the end of the day, investment in innovations, driving innovation, being encouraged to drive them forward makes huge, huge difference for the success of an organization.
So in terms of the kind of leadership roles that you had with HP then, what did you, you know, what worked and what didn't work? I mean, what kind of lessons can you pass on to the managers that are in the audience?
I think that's an interesting question. I think one of the key things again is one is embracing change. I think change is unavoidable. It's always happening. The question is just how do you deal with it personally? How fast can you be comfortable with it? And then making sure that you can make your team comfortable with it. An organization going through change, you always find a different set of people. You find people that are embracing it very easily. You find people that need a lot of convincing. And unfortunately, there are people that are not, that you can't take with you on the journey. As a manager, I find it essential to be clear of identifying who is who, giving everybody the chance to participate. But after a while, it comes to the point where you have to make sure that you move forward as an organization. And as unfortunate it is for the individual, you cannot afford to take people with you that are just resisting to adopting a new direction. So make sure you find your allies, make sure you find the people that are with you on the journey, make sure you spend the appropriate amount of time, help, support for the large group of either individuals or even teams that are in part of your organization that are struggling, but helping them to be successful, and take those with you on the journey and then make those moves. And the other one is the embrace innovation. I think there's a lot of smart people, a lot of opportunity in an organization that can be leveraged. People have different styles, so sometimes I like to talk. I tend to dominate a conversation, but I find that in the room there are many, many people that are often much more smarter than I am, especially in a specific area. So I really want to stop and give them the opportunity to contribute. And it's amazing the results that you can see when those people step out of their shell, they thought things through, and they bring the team dramatically forward. I think that what HP did well, they embraced those ideas and really drove them forward, productized them, and had a long list of very, very big successes doing so.
So it sounds like it was an environment that was able to tolerate some risk so that people were able to be risk-taking?
I think absolutely. I think if your organization becomes where risks are not accepted anymore, you might be moving along and keeping the status quo for a while, but eventually the world around you is going to change. And the only way you can deal with change or even initiate change is being able and willing to take those risks.
So when Farina came on board, then was there sort of a culture shift within the organization?
Absolutely. I think personally, I would say I've definitely experienced that and seen that. I think it was more important. It became more important of how you position yourself then and how important the project looked than what the fundamental changes and innovative moves that could have been delivered would be there. On the other hand, I think it might not be fair to not look at the other side as well. The old HP had simply missed a huge opportunity in the PC space, and Carly Fiorina had the guts and really moved forward and drove the Compaq integration to make up for it. And if she hadn't done that, who knows where HP would be today.
That's interesting. Now, you've had so many roles with Microsoft. Can you talk about those roles and then share some lessons?
Oh, absolutely. I think Microsoft, I joined in the early 2000s, actually went to a very similar cultural change over the last 10 years that HP did before. I joined Microsoft in a role that was assigned to a group under Jim Altshuler, which was called the Platforms Business Management Group. That team, or Jim at that time, owned basically every Microsoft product with the exception of Office. So he owned Windows, Windows Server, the embedded products, the mobile product. He owned Exchange and the SQL product. So a wide variety of products, which gave me the opportunity to really talk to leaders across the organization, help them to identify gaps as well as solution paths and really drive those forward. I got to work during that time with some of the old-time Microsofties you can read about. And I firsthand saw the company changing. The Microsoft as of 2010 culturally has really not much in common with the company you could read about in the late 90s in books like Breaking Windows or The Renegades of the Empire. By the way, really fascinating reads that pretty accurately described what Microsoft was in the late 90s, mid to late 90s, but the company today has fundamentally changed. It's a very, very different, in some areas, a very grown-up organization compared to what it was only 10, 15 years ago. I think one of the things that both companies, HP and Microsoft, have in common is really the value they deliver to their customers and through the work environment. By ensuring you have the best people in one spot, you have them work together, and you give them the tools to be successful. Cost, of course, is always a factor, but in both organizations, it was far more important, and the leaders understood that it is more important to let their people do their best work and get obstacles like inadequate infrastructure, tools, and so on out of the way as quickly as possible, as well as to embrace technologies when it became necessary or when it became possible. For example, in HP, we already used in the late 90s, early 2000s, NetMeeting, which was just a little tool included in Windows for collaboration and communication, which today, of course, with the live meeting platforms and the go-to meeting platforms and so on. There are very professional ways out there. But in HP, that little tool became a standard of how business was conducted. I had teams all over the U.S., where the team members were all over the U.S., and we actually used those tools to work virtually across different time zones, different locations without traveling, very, very early on. I mean, business practices that are today starting to take hold in a lot of organizations, HP was already embracing in the late 1990s.
Yeah, you talked about sort of the culture being considerably different, let's say 10, 15 years ago compared to today. What do you mean by that? Can we drill into that further?
I think a little bit. Yes, sure. If you look at the old Microsoft, I think it was really a very more driven organization that was more focusing on what can I do relatively quickly to make a huge impact with the customer environment, and less and less of what's our customers need today out there. So the culture in the engineering world has really focused on always on the next product and how to make a great innovation, and less about what the current product is out there. And I think this has changed quite a bit over the last years. When you think about how important it is to engage with the customer through the transition process from one technology wave to the other, Microsoft has invested a lot, not only on the technology development side, but also on the sales and services side to help customers taking advantage of those technologies in their own organization. Partly of this was driven by customers complaining and said, Microsoft, you need to do more at this area. But it really triggered a cultural shift where the company is embracing the need to not only develop great products and ship and throw them over the fence, but really engage with customers in the process of making the most use of those technologies. At Microsoft, I said I had the opportunity, especially in the earlier years, to work with executives that had gone through the very famous, all these Microsoft millionaires, basically, that didn't need to go to work. They came to the office and said, I really believe in the change I can drive here. And that's what I wanted to do on a day-to-day basis. They went out and said, okay, this is what our customers need. This is what the future will look like. And I'll do whatever it takes to drive this innovation, to make sure we have the opportunity to drive these things forward. And some of that culture is, I think that really is still around, where you have a lot of smart people, especially in the development organizations, that are very, very passionate about the market, about the customers, and about technology trends and how to leverage those technology trends for the biggest value for the customers. Stephen, I think one of the thoughts that I just want to make sure I don't forget is what makes Microsoft such a special place is this interest of giving back. As I said, I think it's in the product, but it goes beyond that. I think Microsoft, and it's not that often reported, is one of the biggest corporate donors, or the employees of Microsoft are the biggest donors for charity in general. And that really goes through the whole company. It's part of who the company culture is, or who the company is, and help and utilizing the assets, if it's financially or technology, to really make a difference in the world is a big, big motivator for a lot of people there. Over the last years, I think I write this in my book as well, there's a little section on this. Microsoft has actually built a response team to natural disasters and catastrophes around the world. I think following the tsunami several years back, to the catastrophes in New Orleans, Haiti, the earthquakes in Chile, a lot of these efforts have been coordinated based on Microsoft technology. I mean, we have seen how impactful collaboration and communication tools at the right time can be, how important it is to make those available even to organizations that don't have them in hours, not in weeks or months, and have been able to really make an impact of how effective rescue teams can bring their strengths to bear. And at the end of the day, it made a difference between life and death for hundreds, maybe thousands of people across the world. And it's really impressive to see what's possible if the right motivation is there.
Can you describe some of your interactions with some of the senior executives? Maybe an anecdotal story of some sort? Or
sure. I think it actually started on one of my first days in Microsoft. At that time, a gentleman, I think Brian Valentine, who is now an executive at Amazon, welcomed new employees in something like a little roast. He called it the Windows Informational Meetings, and where new employees had to come up. He asked him a couple of questions: where are you from, what do you do, and roasted them a little bit. I had the opportunity at mine. Steve Ballmer was actually there. He personally shook my hand, welcomed to me, came to the company, and it was just an impressive feeling to get off to a great start that way. And it helped me to, I think, to have that, at least that feeling of a personal connection when we had our first meetings with Steve. At that time I was in a team that we did a lot about licensing acquisitions and potential acquisitions, and we had to present a business case for a potential acquisition to Steve. And I have been very, very impressed with the level of work that went in before we went out, but also the ability to understand and very quickly understand where the weak points in that particular environment were. And Steve definitely nailed a couple of those things, was very quick on getting to the whiteboard, taking the initiative, driving the discussion in a different direction, but in a good direction there. And it definitely made the outcome a better outcome. Bill is one of those people that have fundamentally changed, the face of the earth, both at Microsoft and now with the Gates Foundation. And during my time there, I had a couple of opportunities of engagement with him. I think never forget the first time I was sitting in a large conference room, 30 people in the room, discussing licensing of protocols, which is, of course, today one of those cornerstones of the interoperability story Microsoft is driving. And Bill basically had a specific question that then I stood up and was able to answer based on my history of working on one of the first protocol licensing programs that Microsoft had driven, working and collaborating around the SMB protocols, the SIFS protocols that some of you might know. And basically, helping one of our competitors, the Samba community, to build a product that interacted better with the Windows client.
You know, that's really interesting. So what would you say are the top 3 to 5 attributes that makes a person successful at Microsoft?
I think passion for technology is the first and foremost one, and I've used that in my interviews quite a bit. So a little cheat sheet here for people interviewing at Microsoft. Don't be surprised if some of the interviewers actually ask you for your favorite Microsoft product, your favorite gadget, or your favorite technology in general. The reason there is really to understand where you're coming from, what makes you passionate, how passionate are you? Because the reason is not so much what you like, but why you like it and how much you know about it. So passion for technology is one of those key things, and it goes across all company functions. I think even in finance, you will find people that are driven by this. The other one is driving for results. I think there's very little patience in the organization for not getting things done, and following through on your commitments is very high on the list of priorities. So if you're standing up and saying this is what I'm going to do by that time, you better get it done. Or if whatever unforeseeable things happening, you're being upfront and very clear of what's happening, why it's not happening, and what the mitigation plans are. And last but not least, and one thing I have always appreciated is the no BS, if I can say that, attitude. I think even in my first interview, the general manager at that time asked me a couple of very technical questions that I wasn't prepared to answer. But I think what I understood then after this, and I basically said, I don't know. I don't know the answers. I apologize. This is what I would do to probably figure it out, but I don't know. And I think that was exactly, that was the right answer. It was really about, am I able to say when I don't know? People, if I'm asked a question, I provide an answer. People want to be sure that they can rely that the answer is correct. And it's better to say I don't know and I find out the answer later on than pretending I know something and decisions might may be done based on that trust. And that ruins the overall process. It ruins where the company can go, and it ruins the individual and the organization's reputation where this person is coming from.
I guess I'm really struck by your comment about execution, and I hear that in many of my interviews. Is that, you know, that's a big, you know, a key factor for most senior executives. They want to see execution.
Yeah, and I think it's making things happen even when they're necessary, even with little resources, leveraging as much as possible of what's already out there. I think one of my last roles in Microsoft was actually helping to drive, or I was responsible for driving all the pre-release programs for what became Office 2010, SharePoint 2010, Project 2010. We basically built from scratch the largest public pre-release program ever done in Microsoft. We had over 10 million individuals downloading and installing the software months and months before we actually launched it. And that was only possible because we were able to very focus to understand what we needed to be done, what needed to be done for the development organization to build those products, and then going out across the company, across groups, and leveraging all the assets that have been out there to really drive these things forward.
I'm also hearing that Microsoft is a relatively flat structure in the company, and there isn't a lot of management layers, so that, you know, you have a lot of flexibility in talking to different people within the organization. Is that true?
As a general statement, yes, it is true. Of course, if you look at comments from Microsoft employees, if you look at the mini Microsoft blog, for example, there's always discontent about the level of mid-level management. People think there is too much, and in some areas that might actually happen. In some areas, you would say there people have become managers who are very good experts in their area. That does not necessarily make them good managers. Like in every other organization, I think you will find those as well. Structurally, especially for example in the sales organization over the last years, Microsoft has actually purposefully increased the level of employees to managers. So basically taken out a couple of levels of management, streamlined the organization to go back to a more agile organization there as well.
Now, can you describe your current roles and then share some success stories?
Absolutely. After my career with HP and Microsoft, and during this time, I presented on many, many topics. And one of the things, managed large organization teams, coached people either inside my teams or outside my team. And over the last years, I had the opportunity to take that knowledge and take that experience. And it became crystal clear for me that this is what I really like to do. So customers always asking, how do I make the technology work, but also how do I make it work in my organization? How do I actually leverage it? So what I did is over the last years, I found a couple of people that have similar passion, similar background on one side, but also complement the skill set I bring to the table with very unique experiences on their side. So when writing Agility, I had the opportunity to really focus on what I like to do, sharing information, helping others to be successful on their journeys, and to achieve growth in their personal organizational potential. And that's what I'm doing full-time now. As the CEO of EdgeTech Corporation, by the way, it's pronounced Edge, like the bleeding edge of technology adoption, starting with an A-D at the beginning, is dedicated to maximum our clients' value. Together with my colleagues, I now spend most of my time coaching and mentoring other leaders around the core areas of expertise in value maximization for my team, general management, and based on my personal background, intellectual property strategy. The consultants of EdgeTech cover really most business areas and many industries, so they hit the ground running every day when they start in a customer project. What we don't do is broad organizational consulting. Our customers are usually leaders and individuals in an organization. Often they work in large organizations, but sometimes also in startups or in the investments groups that are helping startups to get up and running. We're helping them, coaching them with their specific challenges to make them more successful in the organization and therefore their teams as well. One of the interesting side effects by engaging with the startup community sometimes I'm personally asked to take a more active approach, and then, as I said, the drive for results comes through, so I take on a much more hands-on activity with some of those startups and basically jump in as their acting COO, making sure that the business functions are up and running, making sure we have the right strategy in place, making sure we have the right people in place for functions like marketing, sales, infrastructure, and complement often a more engineering-focused organization with the business savviness to be successful and get the business off and running and off the ground.
So it sounds like then that if there's private equity injection into a company, sort of like through growth funds, or if there's venture capital injection into an organization to take it to IPO, maybe a strategic merger or something like that, they would hire you and your company to provide that professional aspect to the management of that organization.
That is correct, as well as the organizational founders themselves, and they are going out for either the first round of angel funding or the broader investment money. One of the key categories for investors is making sure the company has the right management team in place. So they have not only the confidence in the technology and the market opportunity of that technology, but more importantly in the actual organizational capability of the startup to stay in business, to basically get the basics right. So what I'm doing is, because I've done this now a couple of times more than that, I'm basically making sure that all the T's are crossed, the I's are dotted, and the right people that are available in the market are brought on board to making sure that the organization has the best platform for a successful start.
Now, to do this, do you go on a fee basis, or do you take part equity into the company, or a combination of the two?
The answer is yes and yes. It really depends. I have the good fortune of through the mentoring and consulting engagement, the speaking engagements, to do what I like to do at least some part of the day. And engaging with those organizations is, I think, it's very stimulating. It's mentally stimulating. It's working with really motivated people and driving these things forward. And often they are very cash-strapped, of course. So that's the last thing they have. So really being able to find a equity opportunity there that can pay off in the long run is an upside, but mostly it's a very interesting environment to do.
So will companies engage with you as well to help them seek angel or venture funding?
Yes, exactly. So I'm helping a company here in the Seattle area to get to the next level of fundraising.
I see. So you have relationships within that marketplace in the financing area.
That is correct. And sometimes I'm asked by those folks as well, that this is a company where we're looking into, would you mind to spend a few weeks of helping them out?
Now, are you looking into the Asia marketplace at all? Or?
I've personally spent quite a bit of time during my times, especially with Microsoft, in Asia. So I had opportunities to work with our development organizations in China. I'm not sure if you're familiar, but Microsoft has huge development facilities both in Beijing and in Shanghai. So I had the opportunity to work both with those organizations directly. I've been in our large development organization in India, which is located in Hyderabad, and worked with the development organizations there more on the a lot of focus on this engagements with around intellectual property creation. But of course, also with the other development organizations we have in Europe, from Ireland to the research facilities in Aachen in Germany. So really across the globe, really enjoyed that. On the Japanese side, a lot of folks don't know this, but especially in the office development side, actually a lot of this is done in Japan. Close to Tokyo in Chofu is a huge development lab that has been run very successfully for decades, actually, out of the Japanese subsidiary.
So you're obviously multilingual, so what languages do you...
I would say I stutter fluently in two, English and German. But growing up in Europe and at the university track there, it's required to have a relatively large set of languages. So I tried over the years, I tried to learn French, tried to learn Latin, which is really helpful with all the ancient Romans running around, and a little bit of Italian.
That's interesting. Maybe even a spattering of a Mandarin.
Other than ni hao, I think it will be it has to be really thin, but yes. My Japanese is probably a little bit better than my Mandarin today.
Now, I asked you if there are any success stories that you want to share.
I think successes are really every day. Mostly in what personally satisfies me is if our clients can see the success relatively quickly in their personal environment and in their organization. So just to give you one example, we had an executive moving internationally to one of the large companies here in the U.S. and through a client we had worked with before. We got introduced, and I had the opportunity to really jump in with my team, and I helped that person to very quickly find out what are the key priorities this organization is caring about, what are the resources available, and what is the network inside his organization and outside his organization that individual needs to build up, and then complement him, helping him very quickly to build a very strong team of individuals and other leaders to drive this forward. So when you usually think about somebody coming on board, the first 6 months they basically just try to learn what's going on, and then they're starting to be productive in month number 12 going forward. And in cases like this one, we basically are able to shorten these months into weeks. So we are now in month number 4 of this person in role, and we just caught up about a week ago, he came out of an executive meeting where the leadership of that organization basically congratulated him how well things have been going, how impressed they are, how they are moving forward. And he personally feels in a much, much better spot. The ambiguity of the beginning is gone. He feels super productive and up and running. And I think those are the things when I really can say it's worth it. It's worth what I'm doing. And a successful client there then leads to introduction to other organizations. So after this discussion, we had, he of course talked about his experience. One of his peers now, I'm working with them starting next week on organizational building.
Well, that's really interesting. Now, you know, at the very beginning of this discussion, you mentioned your book. So let's talk about your book in more detail. For example, what led you to write this book, and what's the reason behind its title, Agility?
Glad to share that with you, Stephen. In my role, I have presented on many topics, from intellectual property to sales planning and organizational development. But one of the things I found over the years is the impact of IT is having on an organization and their personal success become more and more clear. So over the last years, I've presented quite a bit on this topic of the impact of IT on business success. And I've also been part of a team in Microsoft that was utilizing a Gartner model of infrastructure optimization to identify where customers are on their journey of IT maturity, to collect data and basically recommend to them how to move forward. Bringing all these people together, all these parts together, really helped more and more to answer the question, not only how do I make technology work, but also how to make it work in my organization. How do I deal with organizational challenges, both in the evaluating, the rollout, and the leverage and utilizing of technology. The book concept of agility is basically based on this original speech I'm delivering since 2007. What we did is we worked together with leading researchers from youth methodology from MIT collaborated with the team from Boston University, and leveraged all of these smart people and the experiences they have gained across the globe over the last 5-10 years, and pulling this together in something we think is the blueprint for understanding how IT impacts business and how to leveraging IT to drive business forward. Agility is really the best word describing the organizational capability to adapt and to leverage change. And we think IT is the biggest lever, if we look back over the last 10 years, that organizations have to change fundamentally and make themselves more competitive.
So what is the link between an agile infrastructure and business performance?
The research shows that IT has, as I said, has been a key lever for business success in general. I think there's a study that came out in 2009 that showed that 75% of productivity improvement across the industries in the 10 years prior, so from 98 to 2008, 75% of the productivity improvement has been driven by information technology. And I think a lot of people are not aware how much the world has changed, but if you even look in the consumer side, I mean, digital photography, instant messaging, all this email, all of these things 15, 20 years ago were not even on the radar screen. And it has really changed how we're acting today, how much more productive we as individuals and as organizations we are. The research shows that IT agility, all this data on IT maturity we have collected really helped there, is actually a good proxy for organizational agility in general. How fast an organization can adopt an IT capability very often indicates how fast this organization can change in general. Not only the organization top-down, but it's also the individuals in the organization, how fast can they move. Through my role in Microsoft, and again, the collaboration with the leading researchers, we had this unique opportunity to actually analyze thousands of data sets on IT maturity, look for patterns, and then did comparisons both across industries as well as inside an industry. The results are really stunning. If you look at, for example, the IT maturity data from the summer of 2008 in the of banks and financial institutions, you could have predicted the stack ranking of where the financial organizations are in 2010. One of the stories I'd like to tell is in the summer of 2008, I was in downtown Manhattan and hosted a roundtable with the IT leaders from some of the largest financial organizations in the United States. And I usually said there were two groups of IT leaders. The one that are telling me and asking me how they can use our technology faster, what are their technical challenges they are having, how they can overcome them. And then we have the other group of customers and of IT organizations that are telling us, what we have is good enough. We are thinking about moving to the next wave in about 2 or 3 years of product. What's the value in the next version? Why would I use a new technology versus the technology I already have? All the costs are so high, and so on and so on. And that was the summer of 2008. Today, the second group of customers are not around anymore. The Lehman Brothers are gone. And the first group of customers, they are still around. The hedge funds, Goldman Sachs, all of those are still leading financial organizations. They had a hard time. A lot of them had hard time and challenges over the last years, but they're still around, while the other ones, the slower ones, are simply not. I think there's a good book called It's Not the Big That Eats the Small, It's the Fast That Eat the Slow. And you can see this on the IT side as well. Another industry we looked at in the book is actually the automotive industry. And again, looking at the data from 2008, 2007, which organizations are agile, which are using technology, you'll find very clearly that today the manufacturing, the cars you probably would like to buy, or the companies you would invest the money in, are the companies that had a very clear IT strategy 3-4 years ago, that are investing into, that have the organization and the IT agility and capability to move forward, and that shows in their product today.
So why should the audience read the book?
Well, it depends who you are. If you are in the IT environment, this book really shows the value you and your organization and your expertise have for the business results of your organization. One of the IT leaders I've talked with over the last weeks basically said, "Yep, that is correct, Mark. But what I'm going to do is I'm buying a bunch of these books." I said, "Why is that?" I said, "Well, this is going to be my holiday present for my business leaders." This really helps to make sure they understand the case and say they're stop talking with me about how to cut costs, but really about how can I and my team help them to drive their business forward. Agility is really unique. Based on describing hundreds of customer experiences, as I just said about the financial and the automotive industry, it really shows case by case, industry by industry, how technology and the agile infrastructure positively impact business performance. The people who have already read it call it really a must-read for leaders defining business strategy and technology implementation. And I think the early successes and the early reviews we're getting are highly, highly encouraging. So I'm really looking forward to see the momentum driving into the next level, and also utilizing that to engage with the reader, with the community more, and having more of these discussion of how can we help, how can we leverage technology to drive the business success. The methodology described in the book of how to leverage the technology will really help the individuals, but also the organizations as a blueprint on how to measure and accelerate technology adoption, and to optimize and to speed up the impact that technology can have, and will have, and is already having to their own business and business results.
So what differentiates your book from competitive books?
I think there's really nothing out there like agility today. And let me explain to you why. I think if you looked at, like Nicholas Carr is a great example, he really asked a good question, does IT matter, in the Harvard Business Review originally, and then I think in his first book there. And said, why does IT matter? And I think agility really goes a couple of steps further. It said, yes, IT matters. IT matters on a variety of things if you want to stay in business, if you want to continue to compete and stay competitive in your environment. You have to live up to the Jones. So let's look at the automotive industry again. If you're in the automotive industry, having superb data warehousing capabilities is an absolute must. It doesn't differentiate you from your competitors to have fabulous data warehousing capabilities. And a lot of these organizations do that. The focus on supply chain management over the last decade really has helped them to build great inventory of data. But what differentiates the automotive companies is not how much data they have and how they manage the data itself, but what differentiates them are the analytic and the reporting capabilities. You can really see based on the, if you would stack rank your automotive companies on your own piece of paper there, and then you would look at their reporting capabilities, that's where you can see the analytic capabilities, that's where you would see the differences. All of them great in data warehousing, huge difference in analytic and reporting capabilities. So IT matters. IT matters to stay competitive. You have to keep up with the Joneses. But it matters even more if you want to drive competitive advantage.
So I know that your book is based on global case studies from various industries, you know, involving something like over 15,000 customer profiles, probably the largest database available in this area. So from that then, can you share some, let's say, 3, 4, 5 key lessons from your book that will really have direct value to our audience?
Sure. As I said, I think there are a couple of things that people need to keep in mind. I think one is really that, okay, you need to understand where you are yourself. You need to understand what your business need to drive it forward, and then you should look at what your competitors are doing. Make sure you're not falling behind. I think that's the absolute baseline. But the real interesting things happening at the next step is that where can you utilize technology to drive a competitive advantage? And that's important there is to really look across your own little pond. Look across industries. I think one of the construction companies I'm mentioning in my book has done exactly that. They said, well, they had a new CIO came on board. They just had had invested millions and millions of dollars into a variety of proprietary tools. Part of the infrastructure was upgraded. And what he did is he basically benchmarked his own infrastructure against other industry leaders. He said, well, why does it cost me $200 to maintain a server while Amazon can do it for cents on the dollar, for cents? And really drilling down and understanding what it takes to not only make incremental improvements, but fundamental improvements. And it's stunning, and I think this is why organizations like IP3 and networking organizations in general are so helpful, is if people are actually talking with each other about their experiences, they very often, especially in the IT and especially over the last 5-6 years, can see how much is possible that they hadn't thought about would be possible, say, half a decade before. And leveraging those, bringing those back to the organization, implementing them, capitalizing on it, and then sharing it back to the community, I think are huge, huge opportunities to drive this forward. I think, Stephen, as you mentioned, the 15,000 organizations, we had this unique opportunity under, of course, respecting all the privacy laws and privacy promises Microsoft has made to its customers, to go back into this database and look at capability, IT capability profiles for 15,000, more than 15,000 organizations, and profile them against each other, look at key business indicators, and have a lot of very motivated PhD students and professors and researchers really drilling down and looking into what this actually means for the competitive advantages those organizations have, or if they fell behind, what did they not do so well the years before. And I think the story is very clear, and I would highly recommend all our listeners here today and over the next weeks and months to really making sure they are clear on where they want to go, they're clear of what IT can do for them, and then take bold steps, take those things, make them happen. Even if in the beginning they might look daunting, there's a lot of resources out there, and what seemed impossible 10 years ago, very, very hard to do, maybe even 2 or 3 years ago, might be relatively easy today and nearly a must-have in only a few years from now.
You know, there's this big kind of divide that's been talked about for quite a number of years now, and that's this whole concept of aligning IT with organizational strategy and business performance and sort of getting the buy-in on the business side. And I can see how, as you indicated earlier, that this book could be of value to the business side as well as to the IT leaders.
Absolutely. I think that's one of the things that we are finding, again, in our work and today as well as over the last years, is this divide between the IT side and the business side. Not so much on the goals of making the organization successful, but really partly on the language. It's a different kind of communication, a different kind of expectation on the business side. People that are thinking about facility management, marketing, impression rates, sales per head, those kind of things, are very, very in a different mindset than people that think about network infrastructure load. And having them together in the same room and trying to speak the same language can sometimes be harder than having somebody from China and somebody from Germany in the same room. At least if they have the same subject matter expertise, they find usually much easier common ground than people across functions. They talk not with each other, but at each other or across each other. So what agility helps is really setting the framework for both sides of the table. Oh, actually, it's multiple. It's more than that. It's just the different business functions themselves don't necessarily have the clear communication either. So it really brings all of them together. Agility provides the vocabulary, the framework, and the step-by-step guidance for an organization to identify those challenges, tackle them together, identify, prioritize the investment areas and the focus areas, and then really stay together on this journey through the complete implementation process and the measurement and leveraging of the results.
You know, the book would be a great adoption by business schools.
We think so, yes. I think one of the reasons, so we worked together with Boston University's School of Management, so the interest on from an analytical perspective to really drive this forward. And I think it will become, schools across the globe to really make the case, to being able to take that methodology, do their own research around and say, what do we find out? I'm sure there are opportunities to go out today for some of the PhD students out there and said, hey, this is what Boston University and Mr. Müller-Eberstein found in this area. What can we do? How can we scope a research project over the next 1, 2, 3 years while things are moving into the cloud computing, for example? And what do companies realize that are leveraging this faster? What are the key indicators? And if one, two, or three, or even more of the listeners want to move in that direction, I would be very, very happy to hear from them, share some of the insights and learnings we had through this process. By the way, Boston University is going to publish a paper on their research as well over the next few months, so that should help. But I would be very happy to engage with the academic community there and continue that discussion.
Well, you know, this book just sounds amazing, and I know the audience will find it amazing. And, you know, it's really a good read for any audience, not just the IT audience, but also the business audience. So.
Yep, absolutely. Absolutely. That's what we're finding across the board.
So I'm going to now move to some more general questions. You know, you're this sort of very capable, very successful executive. You've had so many senior roles where you had significant impact on a global basis. So what would you recommend as the best resources for computing professionals to help them in their work?
Stephen, you mean other than my book? No.
Well, of course your book is number one, right?
No. I think, in all humbleness, the number one resource I found over the last years, and it's becoming more and more important, is networking. It's really networking with your peers, but also across organization and functional boundaries. And it's both. It's the personal networking, so really engaging through conferences to personal interactions to the phone, one-to-one on a regular base and with groups, but it's also the virtual environment. I think so it started with MySpace on the consumer side, Facebook, where we started on the private, where it started to merge private, family, professional, LinkedIn here in the U.S., Plaxo and the European environment are basically networking platforms for professionals. So if you would have found somebody 5 years ago and nobody had heard about it, by now it becomes just part of how people interact, how they stay connected, how they continue to drive success going forward. I think that is the number one thing that really differentiates the successful leaders from the rest. Being able to talk to and access resources, human resources, across boundaries very, very quickly and very efficiently makes a huge, huge difference, and it will be far more important going forward. The second one I found very helpful is finding a good mentor, or finding actually a set of good mentors that are helping you personally, and you're in your organization as well, but mostly you, to help you in your personal growth, and helping you to capitalize on your strengths, maybe even validating or finding out more where the strengths are, how they can be better applied, and being able to reflect on yourself and what you can do through those kind of mentor relationships. And this can be either formal, informal mentorships. It can be a hired coach for a certain area. So things like we are doing there that really can make the difference in the impact an individual can make. But it's bidirectional. It's not only finding a mentor, but also being a mentor. Working with your own mentees can be very rewarding in a lot of areas. First, it helps you to actually solidify your thinking. It can help you to be more articulate in sharing the insights you have. But it also, I find it always very impressive what I'm learning from my mentees. I had the fortune to working with great mentors across my career, and I'm very, very thankful for the people that have and are mentoring me in my personal environment and in my career. But I'm at least as thankful for the mentees that are working with me, because I have the opportunity, and I hear this again and again from mentors, that what they take out of the relationship is very valuable for them as well. They learn, again, they have the opportunity to share some of their expertise, but they also learn about challenges and business challenges and business processes, products, technologies they might have never heard about before, otherwise would not have had the opportunity to really drill down. So it's a give and take relationship in both directions, and I would highly encourage the listeners to actively participate in both of these roles and take advantage of them. The third one is utilizing your own strengths. I think being clear of where your strengths are, and I think The most popular books are from Marcus Buckingham. I think I'm just looking at the Go Put Your Strengths to Work book. That was one of his more recent books here. But it's really helping yourself assess where are your strengths. Don't spend too much time. I mean, you have to understand where your weaknesses are, but don't spend too much time of improving those. It's far more important to know where you are good at and capitalize on that. And then making sure that you complement yourself with resources, people, technologies that are making up for the areas where you're not that great. We all have them, so let's make sure you're actually leveraging people that are having strengths in this area. Fortunately, we're all different. There's enough diversity out there so that we can complement each other and together as teams really drive things forward. And last but not least, professional organizations with your peers in your areas. Nothing against industry organizations, let's say the automotive industry organization, for example, but you're staying only in your circle. Really reaching out across industries, but really looking at a functional level and leveraging what's possible there makes a huge, huge difference. Organizations like IP3 are a great platform to learn from leaders in your area. It gives you the opportunity to engage. It gives you the opportunity to reflect. It gives you the opportunity to find peer mentors and discussions in those areas that really can be eye-opening. If you're willing to get out there and listen, it is really, really interesting what is possible and how to leverage those opportunities for your own development and for your organization.
You know, there's this whole concept of IT professionalism and making IT into a profession, sort of recognized like in the legal area or accounting and so on. Can you comment on the need for IT professionalism?
Oh, absolutely. I think being able to define what are you good at is important for the individual, but it's also very important for a group in itself. So they have their own quality standard, and other people know what they can count on. As I outline in agility, I can see this daily with our customers. The quality of available IT and the use how organizations are making it, organizations are taking out of it really makes the key difference. The competence and the professionalism of those who design, build, implement, and manage those IT systems is absolutely essential for an organization's competitiveness and the effectivity, not only of the IT organization, but also of the business in itself. Establishing, as you said earlier, Stephen, establishing a high and consistent standard for the IT profession will not only help the more impactful of the group itself, but it also clarifies and potentially redefines expectations and responsibilities, roles and responsibilities with the other organizational functions. So the people in marketing, the people in sales, the people in facilities, they know what they can count on. They know if they are thinking about how to structure a new, more inclusive work environment, how they can leverage IT to do so. So they know that their counterparts, they have the expertise to understand it, to speak the same language, and really drive change forward on an organizational level.
You know, Mark, you have this amazing ability as, you know, to sort of bridge all the different kinds of sectors that are out there, and you've spanned the globe in your work, and your history also spans many different sectors and many very senior roles. So I think you're in the perfect position. Now, can you provide your top predictions for the future?
Stephen, if I would know what the future in 10 or 15 years exactly would look like, I think I would be able to make a lot more money and be Bill Gates number two. Unfortunately, I think the only thing that is absolutely sure is that change is coming, and it's not going to be slower than in the last 15 years. I would say we have seen nothing yet. The last 15 years, if you look back, have been fundamentally changed our world and the way we work. And if you would have asked somebody in 1995 what the world in 2010 would look like, well, you can see some of the movies that have been made then, and it looks pretty different today. A lot of the things have not materialized, but our world probably has changed in a far more fundamental way through how we communicate and even interact with each other. 15 years ago, neither email, ubiquitous cell phones, instant messaging, or social networking were visible for most people then. Some of these not even 5 or 10 years ago. What sure is, if you look in the future, that change will not slow down. It will only speed up. That's, I think, the only sure. That's a very sure thing. Organizations and individuals' ability to adapt and leverage this change and how to take the how fast and how impactful they can take advantage of the change. Of great will define if the changes are great opportunities for them or if they make them disappear. They will, organizations that will not be able to capitalize on it, they will eventually wither and disappear. The new IT capabilities we will see will provide to more people. The new IT capabilities we will see will come. We don't know yet what they will be in 5 or 10 years. But one thing is sure, people want them and people will need them. So the IT organization's role, I think, will change dramatically. It will become far more far less of how do I get the bits and bytes right, but more importantly, how do I deliver capabilities to the business organizations faster and more impactful? The way we actually doing it, we in the IT community, we are thinking far more mostly how do we actually implement something. For most of our end users, for most of our business users, that is a more and more irrelevant question. They just want to have it. They want to turn on the tap and the water is running. They want to click on a button and they have the capability. They want to have a device and it should just work. They go out and buy the latest iPhone or iPad and it's just expected that they will have access to the business infrastructure they need to do their job more effectively and using those tools in that environment. So the IT department becomes more and more a capability provider than to the rest of the organization and an enabler for the rest of the organization than a little shop in the background that keeps the lights on. Having the experience and the capability knowledge will be a requirement for the IT community. Again, it doesn't really matter if it's delivered through in-house development, in-house implementation, or a cloud solution. For the end user, that is simply not important. All of us IT professionals, our role is changing. Our role is to make sure that the value of the capabilities to the businesses is clear, that we consult them and help them what we can do for them, and then how to most efficiently provide this capability fast. For the leaders in the IT department, this can be either having the right people on board, having the right skill set on board, having the right vendor network on board, as well as knowing where and when to outsource, when to use outsource scenarios, technologies, when to use cloud scenarios. I think there are a couple of key areas where we will see big change over the next years, and some of the stuff we've seen in agility goes in that direction. What differentiates winners from losers is around data analysis and insights. Collecting data, having data, managing data itself is just there's so much information out there. The information overload is everywhere, but what you make out of this information, how you can pull them together and make decisions, this will be, I think, one of the key things where we'll see fundamental changes. Referencing the book one more time, I think if you look at, there's a story in there on what Bloomberg is doing in the commodity market, of how a vast variety of information sources is pulled together and then presented in a far more consumerized way on a map view. Between synergetic effects of those things is just a fundamental different way of analytics, and it just shows us a glimpse of the future of what we will see across a lot of other industries for internal analytics in an organization as well. The other area will be, I think, about managing all of this data. If really on an individual, on an organizational level, there's more and more information available. The concept of privacy and security will fundamentally change of how we're enacting with it. I think the Facebook discussion over the last few months really started to shift how people think about their personal information, their personal data. And I think we will have a lot of discussion in society in general how we want to deal with that. Again, I think for the IT community, it's up to us to play an active role in that discussion, but also an informed role in that discussion, but also helping the rest of society, rest of the organization to make the right decisions there, and then to implement those decisions, whatever they will look like at the end of the day. And the third one, I think, top of mind, is fundamental change we are going to see in some industries. Let's pick on the healthcare industry. I think if we started to peel back the onion there and see how sometimes archaic the process and the IT management in the healthcare industry is, it's really starting to be scary. And this is not only cost saving. We're talking about life savings here. Thousands and thousands of lives every year, maybe even millions across the globe that could be saved by better processes, by better infrastructure. And none of this is really rocket science. All of these things are out there. They're existing today. And I think as soon as the press is able to actually understand and articulate it, we will see a huge push there that people said, that the general public say, I'm not putting up with this anymore. I want to be safe. I want to drive things forward. And I think IT can and will have to play a key role there both on the development side of medications to how processes are run in a hospital. I give the example of scheduling surgery rooms and scarce resources in general. Well, IT can make a broad impact across the board there. Healthcare is one of those areas, but I'm sure we'll see it in more and more areas.
That's interesting. So I'm sort of fascinated by your answers, and it kind of brings to mind then, what are the most interesting questions that you get asked, and what are your answers?
Well, I think I'm getting asked here, so I make a living of answering questions and trying to figuring out answers together with my clients and my colleagues. But I think stepping out of the discussion we just had, I think some of the questions that are on a little bit more higher level that I'm hearing on a regular basis is really more on an organizational change. So for one of the questions is, how do I get my organization to move faster? People understand what they can do. They know the potential out there. They say, what can I do to make it faster? And my answer in that area is basically very short, is that just pull the plug, turn on the heat. And so what I mean with this is, most people who are in organization who are resistant to change, they're simply not motivated enough. I mean, it's hard, it's tough, and a lot of people don't like to hear that, but that's the fact. I know a lot of the listeners here are actually in the Commonwealth, so let me share one of the stories I've heard from, it's out of one of the Commonwealth countries, from the CIO of the prison system in that country. And he basically said, when we had a similar discussion, he said, you know, I have two user groups. I have user group one. Those are the nonprofit organizations. They don't have any money. They are highly motivated, and they want to work on resocialization and communication. They're pushing me very hard for instant messaging and video conferencing and Skype implementation and access to data and XML data format, because they understand how important it is and how fast, how important IT agility is for making their scarce resources go further. Then he says, and I have the other group of my customers, which are my government employees of that particular system, where we do not have a cost pressure today. Not saying for every government organization, but for that particular organization, he said. And those people, they make their money by, they have a very comfortable life. They usually have one appointment a day. They get in the car. They drive somewhere. They have the discussion. They drive back. On the way back, they have a stop for a tea break, and they can claim the expenses for the mileage as well as for the phone call. They have 1, 2, 3 meetings a week, and that's good enough. If they would use even the phone to have their conversations, they could have 3 or 4 meetings a day. But because that is not what drives their expense reimbursement, they're absolutely resistant to any technology change, even so far as picking up the receiver. He says, if there's real motivation, technology cannot come fast enough. And I think if you're in a position of leading an organization where you're faced with that challenge, sometimes it really turns up the heat faster. It's like the frog in the boiling water. As long as you turn it up as long as you turn up the heat slowly, they will stay there until they're completely cooked. But if you throw them into hot water, they will jump out again and start moving. And I think that's the same for organizations. It is really, can you create the urgency? Can you make sure that people understand what's happening if they are not changing? Can you tell the right stories across the industries, from competitors, from other industries and experts, that really resonate with your audience and make them move, make them feel the heat so they are willing to move forward? A couple of other questions, I think a couple of other things is really focus on what can you achieve. And I think in the IT environment, we'll see more and more the application of the 80-20 rule as well. A lot of the folks from the economic side know this, that 80% of the results are achieved with 20% of the investment, and you need 80% of the resources for the last 20%. very often a 70, 80, or 85% solution is actually good enough. It's far more important to do it fast, and you can do it in 20% of the time and resources compared to actually getting all the way to get the perfect solution that, especially in our industry, will be outdated 6 to 12 months later anyway. So really being able to be fast and agile is more and more important than becoming perfect at that particular time. And I know for some people that are highly motivated by perfectionism, this is a cultural change, and this is sometimes it goes down to the personal level where they really have to confront their own core beliefs and being comfortable to accept some of these changes. And this can be hard, and that's where organizational coaches can be very helpful, helpful as well. This goes into the next question that I'm often asked, is that if I'm making an investment in an IT environment, should I go for best of breed, or should I look for a homogeneous environment where everything fits together? And I think that was a very valid question 5 years ago, but I think the world has fundamentally changed. It is less about vendor strategies, but more about interoperability. I think, as I said earlier, Microsoft has really done some big steps there with the licensing of the protocols and the understanding there, how all of these pieces come together. It's far more important to have the speed and the synergies coming together quickly. For a perfect solution today, independent how perfect it is, 3 years from now it will be completely outdated anyway. So being able to get to a point where IT and a capability makes an impact fast is far more important. Is far more important than doing something up to the last T 5 years from now. And the last person is often getting on a personal level, actually. Especially here in the U.S., a lot of people often say, you're originally from Germany. Why did you come? Are you planning on going back? I said, well, I feel like a lot of other folks I have been working with over the last decade, more and more international. So it really doesn't matter. Where I am physically, it's far more interesting to be able to leverage and engage across the globe. There's so many great places and fabulous people around the world. So being able to engage with them is what's motivating me. Of course, a lot of my family is still in Germany, and I really enjoy being there, enjoying the German food sometimes, seeing my family and friends over there. But as I said, I have friends here in the Seattle area where I live. I have my family here. I have friends from Beijing to Australia and France and Italy, and all of these are working together, coming together. I think makes it a much, much richer experience where we can learn from each other, leverage each other, and drive things forward.
Now, you'll probably find this next question a little bit difficult, because I'm going to ask you to describe some challenges that you were not able to overcome at the time and what you would do differently now.
I think all of us have a long list of those kind of things, and I think learning from them is very important. And in most of the work we're doing, this is what we're doing, taking risks. A lot of them turn out well, some of them do not turn out well, then taking those learnings and driving those forward. And I think it's being able to take those learnings that are relevant to an individual situation. This is where you can really make a big difference as a consultant. On a general and personal level, I think what I would have done different, I think you and I are having this conversation in English right now. If you would have talked to my English teacher in high school and said, what do you think he will ever be able to work in an American environment or even write a book, I think that would have been not, they would have probably not bet that would have been possible. I think I started quite a bit with learning languages at school and the way it was taught there. But in hindsight, I think what really made the difference is immersing myself in a culture, immersing myself in a problem that made the difference. And today I think I feel more comfortable writing in English than I would actually do in German, to be honest. So I think being able to take the plunge and really focusing on it, if it's with a language, if it's with a business problem, makes a difference. If you go all out and go for it, you can make a difference.
You know, we've talked about many different topic areas. I'm sort of curious then, in looking into the past and today and into the future, can you name some who really inspire you and why this is so?
I think there's a as the human race, we have brought a lot of very, very smart people and great people across the globe that really have made an impact in the past, made a positive impact in the past, and have made a bringing our society forward in the future as well. One of my personal heroes, I would say, is a gentleman that was very active in the mid-50s and 60s in the post-war Germany. His name was Ludwig Erhard. He was, later he became the Chancellor of Germany, but the role I think he really played well was the Secretary of Economics after the war. What impressed me about him is he was actually able of learning from history as well as learning from the latest science of his time. Put all of this together, wrote a book called Wohlstand für alle, or Prosperity for All, that outlined how a macroeconomic could look like and should look like to really help a society in its overall to move forward. And it basically, he then transformed that into a working economy for the country, the social it's called the social market economics in Germany, which is still the foundation for the last 60 years now, the country is built on. So it makes a huge, huge difference there. And I think having the vision, having the intellect to pull all of these pieces together, and then having the drive to make it happen on a country level, that's something I'm very, very impressed with. And I think a lot of politicians today could actually learn from. The other group of people that impresses me on a daily basis are children in general and my children specifically. It's just a pleasure to see when they're stretching themselves to become the most they can become. They really look at their capabilities. They learn, they absorb, they embrace change, and really taking this up to the next level, bringing it forward, bringing themselves forward, and bringing the environment and the society forward. I think those are things that really impress me. On the business side, I think a person you don't often hear, especially in the professional environment, who impresses me is George Lucas. I think if you look at this shy student of film in the early 70s and what he created, both creatively, he created a methodology with the whole Star Wars empire, but he had not only the creative drive, he also had the entrepreneurial understanding and technical understanding of building a business empire around it. We're talking about billions of dollars these days that he has made personally and his organizations have been able to create by having smart ideas, going for them, implementing them as well as possible, and bringing the best people together. What George understood is he had a vision, but he knows he can't do everything himself, so he complemented himself with people that were good, that what he needed to be done, and that were good at what they were doing, and bringing them all together, making sure they are benefiting from it, and creating something that is completely unique and everybody is benefiting from it. That's for sure, I think, one of the key things that impresses me. And you will find people like this across industries, across geographies, and I'm very fortunate and very thankful that in my profession and in my career so far, I have the opportunity to interact with them on a day-to-day basis.
Well, Mark, we're down to our last question, and this is where it's a little bit open-ended, and this is where you choose the topic area. So what do you see as the top challenges facing us today, and how do you propose they be solved?
Stephen, that's a very broad question. That is a very broad question, and I think we've already spent quite a bit of time so far, and I would be happy to have another two-hour conversation with you on that one. So if you have a panel discussion, I would be very happy to participate in there. I think, to give you an answer in a nutshell, I think one of the top challenges we as a society are facing is about resources. And if you drill down one level, if you peel the onion a little bit, it doesn't matter if it's water, if it's climate, if it's food, a lot of this has to do with underlying with energy. And I think the path the human race is on is probably not sustainable for another. It doesn't matter if it's 50 years or 150 years, but there will be a change coming sooner or later. And the way we are dealing with scarce resources, I think, will drive us to more innovation and adoption in that area. Probably quicker, probably faster than slower. The human race is very resilient, as I said earlier, very smart people everywhere. So let's make sure we actually give them the opportunity to drive things forward. I think if we as a society are honest with ourselves, understanding what true costs are for us and for our fellows across the borders, across the continents, I think it's much easier to make the right decisions. And I think that stretches further. Being self-critical sometimes, standing up and saying, okay, yep, I understand, I accept the consequences, I accept what really is going on, and making sometimes hard decisions is in the short term and far more importantly in the mid and long term, the responsible thing to do for all of us in the small environment as well as on the global environment.
Well, you know, Mark, I really enjoyed this session here today. You have just this remarkable extensive history of successes, and you were able to share from this sort of repository of vast experiences and to share your insights with the audience. So we are indeed fortunate to have you come in and do this interview, and thank you.
Stephen, thank you so much. Thank you very much for your warm words. I'm blushing a little bit here. But it was really a pleasure talking with you and through you with the broader audience today. I really appreciated our conversation. I enjoyed it. Great questions that really drive my thinking as well. So I appreciate that. It was really a pleasure and an honor that is on my side. And looking very much forward to continue working with you, the broader IT pro community, the broader business community in the future with IP3. I'm very interested in continuing the conversation with you, with our listeners today, and feel free to reach out to me and keep the dialogue open. I'm really looking forward to hear from you.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Mark Mueller Eberstein, CEO, COO, author, speaker, mentor, coach, and international strategist.